Can we treat chronic lymphocytic leukemia better?
Long-term follow-up of abdominal aortic aneurysm repairs.
Is it helpful for patients to have access to their physician notes with regard to taking their medication?
And estimating the cost of physician burnout.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed Double T, your weekly look at the medical headlines from Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso. I'm Elizabeth Tracy, a medical journalist at Johns Hopkins, and this will be posted on June 7th, 2019.
And I'm Rick Lang, president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso and dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
And as we usually do, we're going to reveal to our listeners that we're recording ahead of time because you will be in France.
And I will be assessing the medicinal value of French food and wine. I'll report when I return.
Keep it to yourself, mister. Let's turn to the New England Journal of Medicine. I said, can we treat chronic lymphocytic leukemia better? So chronic lymphocytic leukemia, or CLL, is the most common leukemia in the United States. Big issue. Often occurs in people when they're older. In this case, what they looked at is a drug that's been around for a while, ibrutinib, and another one, venetoclax. They said, if we use those things in combination, can we get a better outcome? This was a phase 2 study of this combined therapy in previously untreated high-risk and older patients with CLL. All patients had at least one of the following features: chromosome 17p deletion, mutated TP53, chromosome 11q deletion, unmutated IGHV, or age of 65 years or older. So kind of like higher risk patients. They all received ibrutinib monotherapy for 3 cycles, followed by venetoclax with a weekly dose escalation. This combined therapy was administered for 24 cycles. They treated a total of 80 patients with a median age of 65 years. They were able to show that this combination was actually really good. After 12 cycles of combined treatment, 88% of the patients had complete remission or complete remission with incomplete count recovery of their blood cells, and 61% had remission with undetectable minimal residual disease. Pretty powerful stuff.
The two types of therapy used here are Bruton's tyrosine kinase inhibitor and an inhibitor of B-cell lymphoma 2 protein were combined because previous studies had shown they were somewhat effective. There was some complete remission, but oftentimes there was still some detectable leukemia in the bone marrow. But the combination of these two things, almost a 90% complete remission and 60% had no detectable leukemia in the bone marrow in these high-risk patients, this is pretty remarkable result. And importantly, there were no new toxicities. Each of the drugs has their own toxicity, but together they didn't increase the toxicity. And it also decreased the amount of time. These patients were treated for 24 weeks, but usually when they're treated with these therapy, they're treated for a long period of time. They just don't go off of them. So there are many benefits to this new combined therapy.
Right. And on that note, I think we can now turn to one of yours.
Let's talk about abdominal aortic aneurysm repair. That's a weakening of the aorta. And when that happens and the aorta gets to be a certain size, it's an increased risk of rupture. And that's almost always fatal. So when we detect an abdominal aortic aneurysm, we want to repair it. And there are two ways to do that. One is to doing an open repair. And the second is doing an endovascular or percutaneous repair, where we put a graft through one of the arteries up into the aorta. This is a follow-up on a VA study that was conducted 14 years previously. The reason why they did this long-term follow-up was because there was some suggestion in European studies that the endovascular repair had worse mortality. So this was a long-term follow-up of 881 patients that were randomized to either open or endovascular repair. And what they determined was there was no difference between endovascular repair and open repair. After 14 years, about 70% of the patients had died. Most of them hadn't died of their aneurysm. They died of cardiovascular disease or cancer. Now, if they had an endovascular repair, they were more likely to need a secondary procedure. About 27% of those had a secondary procedure versus about 20% that had an open repair. Overall mortality, similar between the two.
Well, if you were going to make this decision or help somebody to make this decision, what would you say?
That's interesting because actually endovascular repair was thought to be more beneficial in the older, frail individuals. In this particular study, they did better with open repair, and the people who did better with the endovascular repair were the younger ones under the age of 70. I think this is a circumstance where you talk to the patient and describe what the results are and let them be involved in part of that decision process.
Okay, that was in New England Journal of Medicine, of course. Let us turn now to Annals of Internal Medicine, in this case, a brief research report taking a look at this issue of open notes and if patients have access to those, does that help them to be more medication compliant or medication adherent? They invited almost 140,000 patients to participate in this. Only just shy of 30,000 actually said, sure, I'll do it, 22%. This was at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Geisinger and also in the University of Washington. Kind of divergent in some respects. They did use different surveys at those locations. When the survey used different wording and response categories, 33% of those patients said, hey, this was really important to me, in contrast to 14% from practices at Beth Israel and Geisinger. They found that access to these open notes was important among those with a high school education or less, where 74% reported that reading their notes helped to answer questions about their medications. The authors note that on average, patients remember about half of the information that's conveyed during a visit. And so when they have access to the notes afterwards, it helps to reinforce that information that was conveyed to them earlier. They speculate that encouraging patients to review their notes and lists and to submit correspondence online between visits could be really helpful, especially because it helps to find errors that are in their record that may enhance safety and improve efficacy of visits. So they said, hey, we have some limitations in our study. Our responses are from a population that's primarily white, highly educated, and whether they were taking their medication or not was a self-reported piece of data. But they do conclude that access to notes, open notes, might be a good thing.
This follows on the 21st Century CARES Act, which was enacted in December of 2016, and it requires that all healthcare providers make electronic copies of their patients' records available to them. And the patients are entitled to a comprehensive summary of their health information, including their visit notes and medications. It did seem to increase knowledge about why medications were used and how it was associated with their condition, particularly in those that had less than a high school education or in the individuals that were non-English speaking as well. So there is some benefits to it. I'm just not sure that medication adherence or compliance is one of the major benefits.
Yeah, and I bet you there are other benefits that are not discerned in the study that weren't asked about, such as feeling more participatory. I guess more what I'm going to call qualitative sorts of things, like do you feel like you're more vested in your own care? Do you feel that you understand more about your health?
And that's fair. I mean, when they looked at the individuals that were in the survey, and again, only about 20% of the people invited actually participated in the survey, 8 of 10 said they did look at their medication list. So they were interested in finding out about it and seeing what it was used for. So I agree with you. There are some benefits that putatively aren't studying this particular study.
Well, and I also agree with the author's assertion that encouraging patients to take a look and say, hey, send me questions, record things in here that you'd like to talk about on our next visit is also good. And the reason I say that, Rick, is because we know very well that this whole model of shared decision-making really is never going to be practical unless people are on a more or less, not equal footing, but at least have more information.
I agree. I think more information is helpful to the patient and to the physician. We have to wrap that, though, in reminding ourselves we have to protect patient privacy at the same time. So trying to balance these two things is something that the physicians always have to be concerned about.
Okay. Let's turn to your final one, and that's also in Annals, the cost of burnout when physicians burn out and leave practice.
Occupational burnout is a syndrome characterized by three key dimensions. One is emotional exhaustion, two is feelings of cynicism and detachment from work, and third is a sense of low personal accomplishment. There's a recent study that said approximately 54% of physicians reported at least one symptom of burnout. That's almost twice the rate of the general population in the United States. What the study attempted to do was to estimate what the cost was, both to the United States and to large organizations that have, let's say, 1,000 physicians or more. Using a cost consequence analysis and a mathematical model and the published data, noting what the rate of physician burnout was, on a national scale, they estimated that approximately $4.6 billion in costs are related to physician turnover and reduced clinical hours that are attributable to burnout each year in the United States. Now, at an organizational level, the annual economic cost associated with burnout is approximately $7,600 per employed physician each year. This suggests that the cost of burnout is pretty substantial.
These kinds of numbers are persuasive, and they definitely say, we need to pay attention to this problem. I am not persuaded that I've seen anything that really comprehensively addresses this problem right now.
I think that these kinds of numbers are persuasive, and they definitely say, we need to pay attention to this problem. I am not persuaded that I've seen anything that really comprehensively addresses this problem right now.
There are a number of universities, academic medical centers, and associations that are trying to address that. And it's not just a single approach. It's going to be a multi-pronged approach. The worst extension of this is the burnout leads to physician suicide. And each year, there are 300 to 400 U.S. physicians that take their own lives. That's 40% higher than the general population for men and 130% higher for women in the general population. In fact, the suicide rate is higher among physicians than it is among combat veterans. I agree with you. We don't have a definitive answer, but there are a number of different strategies that people are employing. Things like establishing a culture of health and wellness, addressing needed changes to the clinical practice to make it better, addressing electronic medical records that are a huge source of burnout, delivering peer support to physicians, and also providing education on the wellness and self-care of physicians. These are just some of the things that are being done.
I need to note that among nurses, it's actually 400% higher than among matched controls who are not in medical professions.
I'd say this is ubiquitous, not just among physicians, but really among healthcare providers in general. All of them, besides undergoing stress, are under a microscope regarding everything they do is scrutinized. It's public information, it's transmitted to patients, as we said, it's transparent. So all of these contribute to the stress associated with being a healthcare provider.
Having been in the profession for a while, would you say that it's worse now than it was when you first started?
I'd say two things. One is I do think it's worse now. I think that the stress among physicians who primarily want to see patients, but we've added a bunch of administrative burden and EMR, and again, scrutiny, has put them under a lot of stress. Secondly is when you look at this, it seems that burnout and stress is higher among younger physicians than older physicians. That is, those under the age of 55 as opposed to those over the age of 55. And I think that has to do with some of the coping mechanisms and some of the generational changes as well. So it's very real among all physicians, particularly worse among those that are younger.
An important problem. On that note then, that's a look at this week's medical headlines from Texas Tech. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all listen up and make healthy choices.